With respect to this idea of the incommensurability of cultures, I cannot resist pointing out that when it comes to imperatives to abstain from pride and cruelty and hatred and oppression, you can find the same universalistic statements in ancient Egyptian literature that one hears today. For example, as Simone Weil wrote, "There's never been a more moving definition of virtue than the word spoken in the Book of the Dead by the soul on the way to salvation. Lord of truth, I have brought truth to thee, and I have destroyed wickedness for thee. I have not thought scorn of God. I have not brought forward my name for honors. I have not caused harm to be done to the servant by his master. I have made no one weep. I have not struck fear into any man. I have not spoken haughtily. I have not made myself deaf to the words of right and truth." That's in Simone Weil's selected essays. I've emphasized the fact that the familiar arguments for relativism with respect to values would, if they were correct, apply to our epistemic values as well, because it's only by appreciating that fact that one can see just how self-refuting relativism actually is. Consider, for example, the views of Richard Rorty, a well-known philosopher who holds that we should scrap the whole notion of an objective world, an objective truth, objective views, and speak of views which our culture would accept. Sometimes he adds, at its best. Now, the view that all there is to values, including the epistemic values, because Rorty does, is a clever enough man to appreciate that the arguments for relativism don't just apply to ethical values. They apply to justification, epistemic values. But the view that all there is to values, including the epistemic ones, is what our culture thinks, presupposes that at least some of our common sense claims can be accepted without philosophical reinterpretation. For example, talk of cultures, when does talk of cultures make sense? Well, what has to be in place before you can even understand talk of cultures is the idea of other people. The idea of other people as having beliefs. In short, the idea of a common world has to be in place. If Rorty were to say, and I did once get him to say this in public at a conference, by the way, but he doesn't say it in print. If Rorty were to say the talk of other people is just marks and noises that help me cope, it would become obvious that his talk of the standards of our culture is emptied by his own life. Common sense realism about the views of my cultural peers, coupled with anti-realism about everything else, makes no sense. If, as Rorty likes to claim, the notion of an objective world makes no sense, then the notion of our culture cannot be more than Rorty's private fantasy. And if there's no such thing as objective justification, not even of claims about what other people believe, then Rorty's talk of solidarity with the views of our culture is mere rhetoric. Rorty, of course, would agree with my claim that scientific inquiry presupposes that we take seriously claims that are not themselves scientific, including value claims of many kinds. He would simply say that we should give up the notion that there's such a thing as objectivity either in scientific or non-scientific inquiry. But at least some philosophers who want to hold on to the idea of scientific objectivity without admitting that science presupposes judgments which are not themselves scientific take a different tack. The only serious alternative, in fact, to admitting that the existence of warrantedly assertable claims as to matters that are non-scientific. That is, that they're warrantedly assertable claims as to what is more plausible than what. That they're warrantedly assertable claims as to what is more coherent than what. Warrantedly assertable claims as to what is simpler than what. And the philosophers who want to deny that, or want to deny that such claims are presupposed by the activity of gathering knowledge, even in the paradigm science of physics, often appeal to an epistemology proposed by the American philosopher Alvin Goldman. It's called reliableist epistemology. According, although actually it's a forerunner of that, was my PhD professor, Hans Reichenbach, in Experience and Prediction and his Theory of Probability. According to that epistemology, what makes a belief in science justified is that its acceptance was arrived at by a method which is reliable in the sense of having a high probability of resulting in the acceptance of true hypotheses. Now, technical objections have been made to this idea, and Goldman has made sophisticated epicycles into the original formulation to meet the objections. But I don't want to get into these technicalities. The grounds on which I would argue this approach does not succeed are more historical. To see why, let's consider the question, on what method was Einstein relying when he accepted the special and general theories of relativity? Now, we know Einstein's own answer. He tells us that he arrived at the special theory of relativity by applying an empiricist critique to the notion of simultaneity. By the way, when he's asked, well, then why don't you apply, since you're troubled by quantum mechanics, why don't you apply an empiricist critique to the notions of quantum mechanics? By a friend, he wrote back, you know my view that Mach and Hume are wonderful medicine for getting rid of nonsense, but they can't give you anything positive. And then having arrived at special relativity, he arrived at general relativity by seeking what he called the simplest theory of gravity compatible with special relativity in the infinitesimal domain. The difference between Einstein and Whitehead was over which was the simplest theory of gravity compatible with special relativity in the infinitesimal domain. By the way, if you want the details on Whitehead's theory, the refutation was the work of C.M. Will, Relativistic Gravity in the Solar System 2, and in Astrophysics Journal, for 1971, page 409, it starts. Now, the physicists who accepted these two theories regarded these as compelling considerations in their favor. But these two methods are completely topic-specific. So this is an aspect, by the way, of the thought of the 19th century philosopher of science, Comte, which is rarely mentioned. That Kant was usually regarded just as a proto-positivist, was in fact in many ways a founder of history of science, and the argument that each science developed its own specific topic-specific methods, that it's a mistake to look for the scientific method. By a kind of lowest common denominator, method will not give you much. And moreover, both of these methods, since both Einstein and Whitehead thought they were applying the same second method, both of these methods presuppose judgments of reasonableness. And the entire physical community thought that Whitehead's way of applying it was unreasonable, although no one deduced a false prediction from Whitehead's theory, as I say, till Will's paper in 1971. And judgments of reasonableness just don't fall into classes to which it's feasible to apply judgments of probability. We can't apply numerical judgments of probability when we don't know what the reference class is. We don't have a probability space. We don't have a sample class. We don't have reliable statistics. I mean, this whole discussion is a replay of Reichenbach versus Ernest Nagel, circa around 1945-1949, Ernest Nagel's theory of probability rejects Reichenbach's reliabilism, which wasn't called that, on just this ground. In sum, not only is there no reason to think that the sorts of judgments I've been talking about, judgments of reasonableness, can be reduced to non-normative judgments, there is not even a serious sketch of such a reduction. Well, we come to objectivity, which of course is what everyone talks about. The claim that judgments of fact presuppose judgments of value has been around at least since John Dewey. And if And if you want to start reading Dewey, I like myself very much Dewey and Tufts Ethics, which was the most widely used book in ethics in the United States until World War II, and disappeared after World War II. It's a great shame, because Dewey's ethics dealt with real problems like male chauvinism, racism, discusses Bolshevism. In explaining why he rejects Bolshevism or communism, he says, you know, my disagreement with Marx isn't about class struggle. I believe in class struggle. Just, I don't believe violence is going to make a better society. And moreover, I think the communists are confusing two things. They think that when you've nationalized something, you socialized. And you know, and after World War II, we got ethics books in which the typical ethical problem was about which do you save when 25 children are drowning at the same time. And so, something rather strange happened. But I also like Dewey's book. If you want Dewey and see Dewey on both ethics and science, The Quest for Certainty is a wonderful book. Anyway, the fact that the claim that judgments of fact presuppose judgments of value makes one wonder why that claim has been ignored for so many decades. I think the real source of our difficulties is the crudity of the notions of objectivity that are so often brought to these discussions. Let's begin by thinking about how we judge objectivity when we're not trying to do metaphysics. Normally, we call, and against the charge, oh, you are, what are you, an unreconstructed ordinary language philosopher? It's like, well, when I first read Austin back in the late 50s, I wasn't convinced that philosophy ought to be about ordinary language, but I was sure convinced that good philosophy can be done in ordinary language. And when you consistently have to violate the way we normally understand a term, something is wrong if you're suspicious about your argument. Well, how do we normally judge objectivity? I think normally we ask things, questions like this. Is the statement being made from an idiosyncratic standpoint? Is the person making the statement showing due regard for other relevant interests and standpoints? Now, a sufficient condition that an ethical claim be objective in its ordinary sense is that it be reasonable from the standpoint of an interest in the common welfare, where the common welfare need not be thought of as something already handed down. The alternative possibility is to think of the common welfare as something that we agree to be determined by intelligent discussion among the persons who share this very commitment. I want to emphasize this is something that I suggest only as a sufficient condition, and by no means a necessary one. Value judgments are not a homogeneous class, and they're different sorts of objectivity. But I will concentrate on ethical claims of this kind, sometimes called claims about the common welfare, sometimes called claims in political ethics or claims in social ethics. If an ethical claim of this sort is accepted by those affected at the end of experimentation and intelligent discussion, then it will be what John Dewey called a warrantedly assertable claim, as long as reasons to question it do not arise. And the similarity, and I want to stress the similarity between asking the question, what beliefs are acceptable from the standpoint of persons who are, one, concerned to be able to justify their beliefs to other persons, and two, to do so by appeal to standards that other persons who share that very concern cannot reasonably reject. That's the question we ask, for example, when we do science. And the questions, what actions are justifiable from the standpoint of persons who are concerned to be able to justify their actions to other persons and to do so by appeal to standards that other persons who share that very concern cannot reasonably reject? The question we ask when we do social ethics. These concerns, like the concern with cognitive values and the concern with ethical values in general, presuppose one another. But this is not the way philosophers nowadays are thinking of objectivity. More often than not, I run into philosophers who attempt to define objective by phrases like, and I'm quoting from recent papers, reality has an existence and character wholly independent of human practices, beliefs, and evidence. Or, quotes, something being the case is independent of how anyone would regard it. Such definitions are philosophers' blinkers rather than workable conceptions. In fact, it seems to me that in contrast with the ordinary use of the word objective I described before, objective seems to be used by philosophers today somewhat as cognitively meaningful, used to be used by logical positivists as a term for claims which really, metaphysically or ontology, have a truth value. But the definitions I just quoted are failures in their own terms, in metaphysical realist terms. For example, with regard to something's being the case is independent of how anyone would regard it. Haven't these philosophers noticed that reality does not have an existence and character wholly independent of human practices, beliefs, and evidence? Isn't it the case that human practices, beliefs, and evidence are a very large part of the reality we talk about, and that reality would be quite different were they different? Well, perhaps causal independence is not what is meant. But then I don't know what is meant. Metaphysical realists often insist that a truly objective statement is one whose truth has, quotes, no connection with warranted assertability, actual or possible. But this, too, isn't just a philosophical shibboleth, because there are many statements for which truth is conceptually connected to warranted assertability under appropriate conditions. And these include many statements which metaphysical realists would class as objective. That there are mountains in the area bounded by 70 degrees west and 75 degrees west and by 40 degrees north and 45 degrees north is an objective fact, if anything is. But given that it's part of the concept of a mountain, that mountains are big enough to see, it necessarily follows that if there are mountains in that area, and if appropriate conditions exist, people who know their own latitude and longitude are there to see them, and there's nothing to interfere with their seeing the mountains, etc., it will be warrantedly assertable that there are mountains in the area in question. Perhaps conceptual independence is not what is meant either. I think it's no accident that metaphysical realists never do tell us what they mean by independent. That in such a case, my mountains case, and in the case of most ordinary statements about observable things, there are people in this room, for example, truth, realist truth, if you please, and warranted assertability under appropriate conditions coincide, is no accident. To understand the claim that there is a mountain in a certain place, I must know what a mountain is. And normally, this means knowing what mountains look like. Grasp of the content of a claim and grasp of its verification conditions are conceptually related for many claims, even if they're not the same. Moreover, such extreme requirements for objectivity as total independence from what human beings could do or could know or believe are irrelevant to ethics from the start. No ethicist except a rampant Platonist, and I myself sometimes wonder whether Plato was a rampant Platonist, would say that what is right and wrong is independent of human nature. Or more particularly, no ethicist would say that what's right and wrong is totally independent of how human beings who are raised in a community with a moral tradition would regard things, or very few ethicists would. Certainly, Aristotle did not hold that what is right for human beings to do or right for them to be is, quote, independent of how human beings would regard it in any and all circumstances. He constantly appeals in his ethics to facts about how human beings would regard things. Yet it's decidedly odd to suppose that the sort of objectivity Aristotle sees ethical statements as having, which, as he says at the beginning, is different from the kind of objectivity that statements in geometry have. But to say that Aristotle was not a realist in ethics would be decidedly odd, or not a cognitivist. For these and other reasons too numerous to go into now, I find the attempt to force us to classify our beliefs as objective or subjective, and then the assumptions that get made tacitly, usually, about which beliefs are which, and may tacitly or explicitly about what follows if a belief is put in this box or this box, decidedly objectionable. Usually philosophy suffers at any given period from this problem of too few boxes. I mean, when I started the work you know, that really led to my career, the first paper in which I found my own voice, The Analytic and the Synthetic, was stimulated really by a suggestion by another junior faculty member, Sylvan Bromberger, that you have too few boxes. A pressing task for philosophy, as I see it, is to challenge these classifications so that we may see the terrain without the distortions which they produce.